one of the immediate bureaucratic aspects of the human rights policy, of course, was that on various arms sales or various sales, the Office of Human Rights Affairs would get a voice in on it. And that's a bureaucratic way things go. Everybody who thinks they have anything to say gets in the act. I had, at one time, this would be early 78, after the serious troubles started around, Iranians wanted to buy some tear gas from us. We went through the most agonizing, bitter, nasty struggle to get authority to send to ship tear gas to Iran, to sell tear gas to Iran. The opposition, I mean, everybody, including Lucy Benson in the security affairs, the desk, the bureau, everybody's thought that made good sense. And don't shoot people, tear gas them. And we made this argument as strenuously as we could. It was a very, very bitter. That's the most, one of the most bitter bureaucratic fights I've ever gone through. I was trying to argue with people, it's far better for them to break up mobs, I said, with tear gas than live ammunition. The fight finally had to be settled by the Secretary of State, which is something. This issue should not be bugging the Secretary of State. It was finally done, and we sold some tear gas. A few months later, they wanted to buy some more tear gas. Exactly the same bloody battle was fought through again. Much to the annoyance of the Secretary. He said, I made up my mind a couple months ago on that. Why bother me again? And so we did have that kind of intense feelings going on within the department and perhaps outside the department. But when it all came down to the final decision, they got their tear gas. When the decision came down in terms of what was going to be shipped to Iran, Iran received just about everything it wanted, few exceptions. It just took longer. The battles were that much more, as I say, bitter and difficult. But the final analysis, except for, I think they were going to receive one less Spruance destroyer than they wanted, I think two less AWACS than they wanted for their F-4s. They wanted a special kind of wiring done for a special missile that was coming on online, called the Wild Weasel, as I remember.
Yeah.
They did not get that. But, you know, this is pretty small stuff, a lot of it. But again, what you created in Iran was a sense of uncertainty. Mm-hmm. And they'd ask for certain number of powers, to say, or army personnel carriers. And rather than those decisions of being taken quickly as they had been in the past, they were long delayed in being made. They went to the White House, where the president personally initialed each sale. So just it led to uncertainty of what are the Americans up to. Well, the Iranians and others have to learn to live with that too. It's just not that we have to do everything they want. But I'm just saying from their point of view, it was made them feel quite uncomfortable.
These delays
at the same time, in the end, they basically won.
Are these delays in arms sales decisions were partly because of a sort of a general decision to reevaluate American arms sales policy?
Yeah.
Does it take President Carter?
That's right.
Yeah. It wasn't just Iran as such, or just a general?
A general.
Yeah.
Where, you know, every month, whatever it was, a great big thick memorandum would go to the president. So, you know, policies for Iran, numbers, amounts of money, approve, disapprove. And almost every instance, approve. But the process was very time consuming. Mm-hmm. And like I said, often to get finally through the department a general recommendation or position was very difficult.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Now, before this issue of tear gas came up in early 78, had there much discussion within the State Department over how much Vance or Carter should press the Shah to make progress on her, on human rights policy.
Let me be blunt. I mean, if I'd had my way, there'd have been no mention of it at all in the briefing papers.
Uh-huh.
I mean, that may make me to be a terrible person. But of course, since we knew what Carter was interested in the briefing papers, there would always be a point or two on human rights. One of the interesting things is in the Carter, in the visit of the November 77, after the first meeting with the Shah, and I think Jody Powell or somebody briefed the press, absolutely no mention of human rights. When I got hold of our press man, I said, you ought to get hold of Jody Powell and tell him this one glaring lacuna here. And we read over the stuff and said, oh my God. So I got hold of Jody Powell and said, from a political, domestic political viewpoint, the president's got to say something in human rights, which he did. And I say something. I don't know, I never saw the precise language. But then Jody Powell, in answer to the question, I said, yes, they discussed the question of human rights and everything. I think the president, not to take away from President Carter, I think he was personally deeply committed to an overall policy of human rights. He's probably far more intelligent and balanced than the people who pursued these policies for him. I mean, he, as a president, he was looking at the totality of the relationship, as I was trying to, people are interested in one particular or not. And so I think he fulfilled, he did what the Shah expected him to do, but he didn't do any more than that, to the best of my knowledge. He never really pounded the table on these, again, to the best of my knowledge, made very specific suggestions.
Had the Human Rights Bureau of the State Department pushed for a more active, a more aggressive stance? I mean, during 77, for example, before the tear gas question?
Yeah. I can't remember too many of the specifics, but I mean, we were so we Iran was one of the targets. I said, again, it was Iran, Korea, the Philippines, get them to clean up their act. And because I was very happy to leave the department at that time, but you're not interested in my my angst particularly, but it was a very difficult period. I get paid for it somehow.
Now, in terms of the basic policy approach, how much continuity was there, say, between Nixon, Ford, and Kissinger, and Carter, Ford, and Brzezinski?
The end result was very much the same,
frankly.
The rhetoric changed, Iranian perceptions changed because of our rhetorical changes, the delays, the nature of the people who were carrying out policy changed, but the end result was damn little change in the thrust of policy, which had started with him way back.
Now, in May 77, Secretary of State Bannis attended a CENTO meeting in Tehran, where he met with the Shah. And there he told the Shah, as you probably remember, the administration would support the sale of AWACS and F-16 jets to Iran at that point. Now, in Gary Sick's book, he makes a point that inside the State Department there was some opposition to the AWACS sale to Iran. What do you remember about this question? So the Vance promised a sale, but but there were people in the department who were opposed, who opposed the sale.
Again, these would be the the human rights people. AWACS would have very little to do with human rights. It would come from that group of people, basically surrounding Les Geld in political military affairs.
He would have been critical of it, or he was critical of it?
I can't remember what Les personally was. But, you know, the people around him took seriously the president's clear desire of the president to cut down on the sale of arms. And that was one of the big points the president made. So they took this very seriously. So there was that kind of opposition. But the, I think the argument was fairly persuasive to the secretary that, that this made sense, military sense, and it made great political sense that for the administration so early on to deny the sale of such an important, sensible piece of equipment would have all the wrong signals to him. As I say, Vance in his own way and Carter in his way of Brzezinski, as I say, brought basically the same geopolitical view of Iran's importance and the importance of the Shah. They sort of came into office with this understanding. Mm-hmm. It's a question of how to balance that understanding and the various commitments since the president had made in his campaign and his early speeches on human rights and cutting down arms sales. Those were difficult times for these people because some of the actions we took were not consistent with the rhetorical policy. It was very difficult for the president and Vance.
And one of the arguments that was made against the AWOC sale was it was not just a defensive system but could be used for offensive purposes and increase the Shah's ability to intervene throughout the region. How would you respond to that kind of an argument? I guess it was made by the critics, some of the critics of the sale, the Senate and elsewhere.
I was going to say that various people up on the Hill, particularly in the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, were gravely concerned that somehow AWACS might be to be used against Israel. It was the major issue that I ever had put to me. The fact that if it flew, it's certain, technical beyond my capabilities to understand, but at certain altitudes with a radar and all that, that there'd be a capability. It turned out there was not that capability. That was one of the arguments that we went back to them on, saying that there is not that capability, from Iran. It was always that an awful lot of it was that kind of concern of individuals who are very closely attached to or concerned about Israeli security. Is that sort of how do we know, just as life turns out, since they were, how do we know that a successor regime will be unfriendly as compared to the regime that we now have? I think one of the arguments made is that, look, you've got a regime which couldn't be more friendly to Israel, and now is not the time to upset that relationship. The other concern that one got on the Hill, and certainly worried early on, worried the technical specialists within DOD of the possible compromise of sensitive equipment.
CIA was concerned about this also. CIA was also concerned about this.
The whole series of people who look at shipment abroad of technical, the civilian high tech or military high tech. And there's grave concern a lot of other people, but don't ask me to get technical, but various changes were made in the equipment or various things were not put in that our AWACS had. Mm-hmm. I think there's a general feeling that even if a plane was taken to the Soviet Union, well, the loss would be considerable by various technical adjustments which would not affect the basic efficiencies of the platform, that we could protect ourselves. As frankly, this is always a concern. Shipment of various kinds of missiles or equipment. Is that?
Well, apparently Stansfield Turner made that argument in public, in a public letter. Well, how did it come about that he would make a statement that would undercut Carter and Vance's declared policy? Just sort of lack of coordination?
There's a lack of coordination, frankly. Basically, the White House on the NSC level, but Turner did have a memo from his own technical people expressing their concerns. Mm-hmm. And as a good leader, he used his paper in that hearing up on the Hill, which really put things on. They had one hell of a basic problem. Here's you have the head of CIA is essentially talking against or expressing concerns about the very policies that the president adopted. Mm-hmm. Within a day or two, he reversed himself, as it was shown to him that technically it wasn't this bad. Hmm. That was a bombshell. I'm reading that in the pen. My God. Here we go again.
Now, James Jones suggests, I think he suggests at some point, that Carter, among others, wanted to pursue the sale of AWACS, probably to encourage the Shah to take a more cooperative approach on oil price questions. There was sort of a political aspect to the AWACS sale. Is this your understanding of
the issue?
I don't think I... Oil prices, of course, at that time were always on the leadership's mind. And God knows, you know, the files may eventually show that some of my memos or other people's memos mention oil prices with respect to larger issues. And more likely be phrased along the following lines is that the sale of or the doing this or that with Iran continues a long relationship that we've all benefited and would put us in a better position to talk frankly about oil prices.
For the political atmosphere, basically.
That within this political atmosphere, we're better able to talk to them. I don't recall anybody ever saying, well, seriously, in terms of out of the department, saying, let's speak out of the Pentagon, I never heard. We ought to tell him that if he doesn't cut his oil prices down, we won't sell him. Now, whether the Shah ever felt that kind of bargain, I don't know. But of course, during his visit with the president, he did agree to withhold any increase for 6 months. It happened at the suit supply and demand at the time, too. I think he saw it as a genuine gesture, a political gesture, Carter, to agree. I think in retrospect, from the Shah's point of view, it was a terrible error.
Yeah, you mentioned that last time, in terms of the domestic political implications. Now, at first Congress rejected the AWACS proposal, and later on they approved it. What was your role in the efforts to turn Congress's opinion around? I guess this is the summer of 77.
Yeah. Like I mentioned last before in the previous discussion, is to say, well, is there a life after AWACS? In the role leading up to where we stumbled, my role was basically working very closely with the DSA people at the Pentagon to make sure that the Secretary of State or anybody else from State who was testifying and from Congress would testify would all be sort of from the same Bible so that our briefing books were consistent. And I did the usual thing my office did. I did a lot of myself, political military affairs. I did a lot of what we call the Q&A sort of thing. And you break them up into, say, one section might be threat to the region. You have a lot of potential questions and answers. Iran's ability to handle technically, a lot of questions, but basically the Secretary saying, we have confidence they can. They can handle their F-4 program well, their F-5 program, their transportation aircraft, they can handle, but my colleague from the Pentagon will be better able to discuss this. So that's the kind of thing that I was heavily engaged in preparing the Secretary's book and the people who would go with him on all this kind of, some of the fairly technical stuff, which I first had to understand.
Did you engage in any lobbying activities, like meet with congressmen and talk about, you know, argue the case?
That's a difficult area. There are certain limits on what one can do in this sort of thing.
Yeah.
I met with a number, small number of staffers who were not involved in the AWACS sale as such, weren't on the right committees, etc., and pointed out my problem and asked for their advice on how one best counters the kinds of criticisms that are going to come up with, or how does one get over that this is to our advantage. I did that sort of thing, tried to get together some material which would show Congress, frankly, how many jobs this would mean, what companies would benefit from it. And one always had in mind the fact that, say, if Raytheon was involved, that people from Massachusetts ought to understand what they did in Raytheon. But most advice I got, the best advice I got, was the most difficult to use, frankly. was look at jobs and look at income. And the foreign policy issues and the strategic issues have to be fought out on their own terms, but what really hits a congressman that this means 20,000 continuing jobs in his district. I mean, they used a lot of that stuff. Whatever lobbying went on after the sale, I was not heavily engaged in. I worked with our political military affairs people, Henry Precht, who was up there, who replaced me as country director, and with the Pentagon to draft the various assurances that we had to get from the Iranians and then give to Congress to take into Congress. So I think that 5 assurances or 6, I've forgotten the details of them. Again, after I was just up to my ears in that kind of thing.
Now, in November 77, as you mentioned, discussed earlier to some extent, you talked about the Shah's visit to the United States with President Carter. What kind of special preparations did this visit require?
It's sort of the usual, frankly.
Yeah, yeah.
The President always receives a number of basic briefing papers. One is sort of a statement. The Shah at this time is, and you describe as best you can, the state of mind, etc., and then lay out the issues that he is interested in, and then of course laying out for the President the issues that we're interested in. Now, he knows a lot of this, but he's got to be reminded of them. So it's that kind of briefing paper that goes forward. And again, we wrote all of those sort of things. And then the State Department gets invited on guest lists and the protocol arrangements, sort of thing. So any presidential visit, head of state visit like that, involves pretty much the same kind of reaction out of the department. And the highlight, obviously, and be very frank with the presence and some of these members, say, we don't expect much substance to come out of this visit because so-and-so really, we have no basic issues, this is essentially a courtesy, and but so-and-so will appreciate very much whatever courtesies and warmth you can show and acknowledge of, and an awful lot of visits are like that, they're purely protocol. But the visit for Shah was not protocol, Although our main argument was, the basic argument, of course, is there are only so many state visits that the President can take in a year in terms of his time, was that the Shah had visited Washington, I guess every President except Roosevelt, he saw Roosevelt in turn, and that it's become clear that he feels a visit would be useful, then go on to say Iran is one of the most important, blah, blah, blah. And we think that as soon as it's convenient for you to have such a visit, that's where you start out, basically, and get him interested, and then they agree, we start back and forth agreeing to a date, then the process starts up thoroughly briefing the President, writing speeches for him, writing toasts for him, writing toasts for the Vice President, that sort of thing.
To the Shah, how was the initiative taken to arrange this visit? Did Carter say the visit should occur and invite the Shah, or was the Shah fishing for an invitation? Or
well, it was made clear. You don't have to. All you need to do is say, have the Minister of Court, I forget whether he did, he probably did, but I don't remember specifically. Mm-hmm. In talking to our ambassador, saying, the Shah has seen every other president. Mm-hmm. We do hope that before too long, we understand how busy he is. And so the word gets around, the ambassador here, Zahedi, you're probably saying it'll be useful to come by. And so when the State Department is told that there are so many state visits going to be permitted in a year, then the internal struggle starts between the bureaus to start out with, how many will get, and within the bureau, whether the Shah should be received before, head of state acts. And you thrash those out yourself, and then make recommendations to the President.
Were you present at any of the meetings between the Shah and Carter?
No. Usually at such meetings, the only persons present would be the two principals, plus on some the Secretary of State and the American ambassador. That'd be just about it.
So be very small room.
Yeah. No, unless if a working issue came up, some other people might be calling. But that's basically your layout.
Now, as you mentioned before, one of the issues that came up.
What often happens on these visits is actually you have it's dual layered. People mill around on each side, 10 or 12 people, the Assistant Secretary of State, and the President might have a half hour, 3 quarters, maybe an hour, one on one, or with just the Foreign Minister, President, depends. But, and then they would come in to the larger setting and tell people briefly what they discussed, what they had decided.
Mm-hmm.
That'd be sort of a favorite phrase, the tour de raison, by which the Shah would talk to us and how he saw the world, et cetera, et cetera.
Okay. Now, you mentioned earlier that one of the U.S. goals during this meeting was to get the Shah to agree to take a moderate position in forthcoming OPEC meetings on oil prices. Was this sort of settled before the Shah arrived in Washington?
He had made his decision
To
do so before or at about the time he arrived. As I recall, he had been in South America or the Caribbean someplace before he came here, and he made a number of statements which clearly signaled us that he was receptive. And then, as I recall, that the night, either the night he met the President or the night before he met the President, he made the announcement.
Uh-huh.
So that took a nettlesome issue immediately off the agenda. You know, right away, well, I've already agreed, at least within the 6 months, we'll not have any increase. And it was due, I forget when the OPEC meeting was due. Once Iran agreed, there'd be no increase that took care of it. You know, as a major swing supplier in OPEC at that time. So that he was smart in terms of his relationship with the new administration. It was a very shrewd move. So instead of listening to Carter use all his talking points about the terrible impact of high oil prices on our economy, and therefore he would have been forced to go into his extremely detailed, knowledgeable counter argument, he just take it off the table. That would be a much more pleasant discussion.
During the weeks before the visit, had you been meeting with Iranian diplomats to discuss this question of oil prices, and how was the issue handled in negotiations before the visit?
No. Yeah. Now, the Shah didn't by and large did not use his embassy in that way. Most things on oil were taken up in Iran. I mean, we did not discuss. You knew what the U.S. government line was. The issue came up when you're meeting with Iranian diplomats. You use it. You know that they may report it, but it's not going to have much impact. The Shah made up his own line, period, on oil.
Now, another aspect of the meeting was a plan to get the Shah to take a more systematic approach towards arms purchases from the U.S. I guess there was talk about a five-year plan of purchases.
Mm-hmm.
Now, around this time, Theodore Moran, of the State Department's policy planning staff, had written a paper arguing that the U.S. should try to get the Shah to curtail military spending so more resources could be allocated for domestic economic modernization and development purposes. Otherwise, Moran argues Iran would fall into social and economic crisis unless the Shah curtailed his arms spending. Did you see Moran's paper at that time?
I did.
Yeah.
I saw it in draft, and perhaps to my regret, I vigorously oppose certain parts of it. I felt it was not well, that it was reasoning from the general to the specific, that there was not sufficient, that he had not what was sufficient evidence and detail. I mean, one particular argument I had with him, I thought he must have been thinking of the great Chinese Revolution, in which he talked about, you know, unrest in the countryside. And I remember very angrily saying, It really doesn't matter what the hell happens in the countryside, but it matters very, very much what happens in the cities. I mean, this is, if Iraq is going to have problems, it's going to be in Tehran and Isfahan and a few other cities. I mean, forget the countryside as such. So I guess part of my opposition to the paper, I probably should read this, was simply that I saw it as another effort to make a basic change in the relationship, and I felt that that was wrong. As I saw, much the way I saw human rights and various other things as one issue, and that was sort of coming from a, pardon me, sort of the liberal academic academia approach. It was not a bad paper at all, and history has shown that he was closer to the mark, except for the countryside, than a lot of other people. I've never seen, I haven't seen him since those days to tell him that.
He's at Georgetown now. I think. How much debate or discussion was there within the government over what kind of approach Carter should take towards arms sales at the meeting with the Shah? Was there much discussion over what kind of a, you said there was a 5-year plan apparently that was discussed, but
the effort, yeah, there was, and I can't follow, my memory doesn't permit me to follow in detail how this developed, but there became a general consensus, which I certainly did not oppose, is that Iran had been buying so much that it would be useful if, and particularly useful domestically in the United States, if we had a clear understanding of a 5-year period of what was terribly important and what wasn't important. It was implicitly, I'm not sure, it could very well be explicit, but implicitly was in understanding. So he's still going to get what he wants, or something like it, and he may have to go to other countries. And if he didn't, it was okay. But it was an effort to get some rationality. And also, this would have permitted the administration to adjust its overall policy of arms sales, of cutting down the amounts. You could shift like a billion from, what have been, say, 78 to 79, 79 to 80, so that the president's overall objectives could be achieved as well. So that general consensus, how it developed, the whole process, endless meetings and discussions and papers and that sort of thing. The Pentagon was very much in favor of it too. Mm-hmm. They're having a very difficult time of handling this huge program. So to get some rationality, they can say, well, 3 years from now we'll get an order for M1's personnel carriers. No problem. In fact, I don't think, as I recall, the Shah did not have that much problem with it before, except to the extent that it had a resonance of our efforts in the 50s, in the 60s, to do exactly the same thing on a much smaller scale, of having yearly meetings in terms of their needs, their capabilities, their training. And so I think that was about the thing, it had that resonance of, here we go again, in which the United States is trying to tell me or us how to run our armed forces and what we should buy. I think he had no basic problem with it, except in that that it brought back to him and the Iranians that period in which we were very much involved. As I recall, and one of the things he said, well, those things I can't get from you, I'll get elsewhere. And the general said, yes, fine, no problem.
Also discussed in this meeting, I guess, was the question of Soviet influence in Somalia, which we discussed already, and in Ethiopia as well. Was there any, what was the extent of the Shah's interest in the Ethiopian question?
I think we discussed this before.
Same as Somalia, basically?
Yeah. He saw Somalia as a, despite the nature of that Siad Barre's regime, as a counterpoise to Ethiopia, and therefore one of the interesting things, and when I said to Sean, I said this before I repeat, we'll ask to type this later, I can edit some of it out, but when Americans talked to the Shah on international affairs, they quickly found a very broad parallelism, if not congruity. They hardly ever had any really heat. You know, if Carter would talk about a particular subject or the president before him, the Shah was there ahead of him, probably would then pick it up and carry on. Because our world views, our belt on Sean, I keep using because I love it, are very similar. He for his reasons and us for ours.
And I guess what this meeting with the question of rock sales and I guess the regional issues such as Ethiopia and Somalia and the oil price questions, were they the main issues discussed at this
conference? Yeah, that's to my memory. Yeah. I don't remember any other issues. We want to make sure the president said something on human rights.
Yeah.
And that was the idea of getting the Shah to come down with an overall 5-year objective, the oil prices. And in any meeting with the Shah, or most heads of state, he has what I said before, the two glories on which each person discusses his view of the world, of the problem points, issues. And of course, you can use a head of state visit very much to get somebody to start thinking about an issue that hasn't bothered them before. But sort of thing, you know, at almost every level in the State Department, you do with your own, with your counterparts at your level. You sit down at lunch and talk. The president would be very well briefed on what Iran's policy would be, what we would like to see it be, and what he's going to say. If you're fairly astute, country director, I'm not just speaking about myself, but fairly astute country director, a president should rarely be taken caught flat-footed.
Now, about the same time as this meeting was taking place, fall of 77, there was growing opposition activity in Iran. Campuses were in ferment. There were protests in the bazaari against the Shah's economic policies. Mm-hmm. Now, how much did you know about this? About these developments at that time?
Well, the embassy would report all of it. So, yeah, we were very much aware of the tensions that were created by the attempts to take the steam out of the economy and the attack on bazaaris and then arresting some of them for inflating, I'll say, gouging and that sort of thing. And the efforts by Muzaffar, I guess it was Muzaffar, and then to cut back on the budget and really get a fresh look at Iran's resources. The embassy reported, I'm not sure exactly when, is that the subventions that they used to go to the religious leaders had been cut out.
Yeah.
Aware of it, I can't remember anybody raising a huge red flag over this. But yeah, we were aware of it, and then because Prime Minister Ansari was, I guess, had become head of the oil company by that time, sometime in 77, 78. He was a political opponent of Muzaffar, so he did the same thing with oil money, that the NIOC money that used to go to the religious leaders, and said, I can do it too, kind of thing. So I think all of this stuff was reported, but none of us sat down, at least I didn't, and drew the appropriate conclusions.
Now, later that year, at the end of December 77, President Carter returned the Shah's visit by stopping in Tehran after a visit to Poland. Was there much substance to this meeting? Did it have much substance in terms of the issues? Or
yeah, they had seen each other 6 weeks before.
Yeah.
In fact, it was the most difficult briefing I ever had to sit down and try to figure out, because I couldn't figure out what the hell they were going to talk about. So they didn't have much to talk about. It was essentially a social occasion. They arrived there. one day, left the next, as I recall. So we had a lavish party, which was went off in great style, with the children, the Shah's children got engaged in it. And I guess about the biggest substance was that King Hussein was visiting at the time, visiting the Shah, and this permitted Karthika during the evening for him to go off and talk with King Hussein for a while. But there's really no substance at all.
Well, I guess as I think about it, I guess there was an agreement on some kind of a $10 billion arms package or something like that. There might have been some agreement on about that.
Maybe I'll be wrong. Yeah. It just, you know, struck me as get in there, had the party, left the next day.
Who wrote the famous toast for the state dinner? Who wrote the Carter?
The only thing is I feel is that he must have written it himself. The desk always provides a toast for every occasion. Mm-hmm. And I'm sure that the one that we wrote for him was flowery and all that sort of thing. It did not have some of the more famous raisins in it, which were put in by him or Jody Powell or somebody who went along with him.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I was taken aback by myself, frankly, when I read it.
I guess it's fair. Now, right after...
you can't lay that one on me unless you can find the document someplace with my signature on it.
just curious. Right after Carter says a Tehran newspaper ran an article that attacked Ayatollah Khomeini. Mm-hmm. And this article sparked demonstrations in Qom that led to violent repression, which in turn led to a cycle of demonstrations and repression, which touched off the revolution. Or the demonstrations in Tabriz and other cities against the repression in Qom, the 40-day cycle of mourning and then demonstrations. What was your initial reading of these developments? Are you still in Washington at this point? Right?
I'm still in Washington at this time.
Yeah.
I don't recall the embassy reporting the text of the attack on Khomeini for several days. They may have it. I just may have been busy in other things.
Mm-hmm.
I would like to say, and I may say this several times as we go through this process, that I was terribly attuned and perspicacious and saw this as the opening battle of the revolution. I didn't. And I don't think anybody in Washington, particularly of the January and even on the February reactions of the 40-day cycle, saw this as sort of the opening shots.
Mm-hmm.
Certainly the embassy didn't. Again, the embassy reported voluminously what happened.
Do you recall any discussion with IRON, with officials from the INR about these events, about what kind of interpretations they had of
I don't recall any, but George Griffin and I would probably sit down every couple of days. He'd drop by the office for one reason or another, sit and chat. But whether we ever sat and really discussed, I can't remember. I do wish I'd kept a diary for this whole period, but I didn't.
Now, in March of 78, James Bill gave a presentation at the State Department in which he argued that the U.S. did not have a bright future in Iran. Were you present at his presentation?
I helped organize the presentation, yes.
Okay.
Frankly, this particular session was largely organized for my benefit. I mean, it was known at the time that I was going to Iran as D.C.
As early as March, yeah.
Well before that, actually. And I asked INR, which had the money and the organization, to bring Jim and some people in just to frankly talk about the religious opposition and as much as anything, because I felt that I just didn't know very much about it. I didn't have a feel for it. So I wanted Jim, a few others, to come in and just talk at me, basically.
I think I saw her.